light out, everybody.
Greetings and salutations, one and all, to another edition of the Radcast 5 Weeks of Fright. I am Jesco.
And I am Chelmsley. And once again, we are your hillbilly horror host for this year's Eerie Endeavor.
Ooh, very nice alliteration there, Chauncey.
Thank you, Jesco. It is one of my favorite literary devices. The cool clouds cleverly cascade the country cabin.
Oh, I like that, Chauncey. Let me try. Nary a nightfall knows the nature of never-ending naive ne'er-do-wells.
Nevertheless, the big blue barrels by, butchering the riffraff, erroneously basking in blissful benevolence.
You know, Chauncey, something tells me we ought not delve too deeply into the world of verse. I'm afraid we might say an evil spell on accident. Then we'd have an undead mass maniac after us.
That's a good idea. I certainly wouldn't want Jason's vorpal blade going snicker-snack on our hillbilly heads. Best stick to prose. Speaking of, you have another story for us this week, Jesco.
That I do. So prepare yourselves, listeners, for I call this The Tale of Rex Wise and Videotape. The year was 1993. Jurassic Park broke new ground at the box office. Bill Clinton was sworn into office, and Rob Pilatus and Fab Morvan, formerly Milli Vanilli, released Rob and Fab using their own vocals. There was also Rex Wise, a local video store owner trying to close up shop for the night.
What do you think you're doing?
He asked his lone employee left on the evening shift.
I'm looking for a movie to take home with me.
The employee replied as he looked up and down the shelves of videotapes.
I'm about ready to not let you take tapes home with you no more.
An annoyed Rex remarked.
Oh yeah, why's that?
The employee asked indignantly.
I can tell what you've been doing in your personal time by where on the video the movie messes up. That don't prove nothing,
the employee snapped back.
Oh, right. You're the only man in this town who checks out the movie Basic Instinct on a regular basis just for the plot. I ain't gonna listen to this no more. Fine, I ain't gonna check out a video. I'll see you tomorrow.
The employee left in a huff. Rex yelled out after him.
Just make sure you ain't late again.
Rex came out from behind the front desk and made his way over to lock up. As Rex approached, a mysterious figure in a poncho appeared in front of the door. Hood up, and what little light shone on the city street, Rex couldn't make out the person's face. Although bothered by this mysterious individual, Rex composed himself.
Hey, pal. It's quitting time. Come back tomorrow,
he muttered gruffly. The figure didn't move.
You hear me, man? I'm locking up to leave. Vamos, amigo.
Just then, one of the figure's arms crept up from below their poncho and revealed a blank black video box.
What? You making a return?
Asked Rex. The figure slowly nodded.
Listen, bub, I don't take tapes back in blank black shells. but I've been doing this long enough to know I should count my blessings whenever anyone tries to return something on time, if at all. So in this instance, I'll make an exception.
Rex took the tape from the figure. The person then turned and walked away, stepping out into the street.
And word to the wise, next time, don't try to come into a place of business when they trying to close.
The figure continued to walk across the street, not acknowledging Rex's words. A car drove down the desolate road, and as it passed, the figure disappeared. Rex looked wide-eyed in disbelief at what he had just witnessed. He slowly looked down at the videotape box he had in his hand. He slowly backed into his store and quickly locked the door. He tossed the tape on the front counter and stared at it. He ran his hands through his hair, then rubbed his chin. He tried to make sense of what he had just experienced. He crept up to the front window and craned his neck, looking left and right as far as he could down the street. There was nothing but quiet. He peered over his shoulder at the black videotape box on the counter, unsure of what could be on the tape inside.
"This is ridiculous,"
he chuckled to himself.
I mean, I haven't even opened it. I'm freaking myself out over what? I mean, it's a daggone blank tape box. Hell, depending on what movie it is, I could have a spare box for it lying around and put it in that.
As he started to compose himself, Rex grabbed the box. He took a breath and slowly opened the clamshell.
It's blank. There ain't no label.
The fear started to rise in his stomach again. But before he started to freak out, he stopped himself.
"Rex, stop it, man,"
he thought out loud.
"It's a blank tape. So what? It's the whole nature of the situation that's making it seem like this is a new occurrence. It ain't. More than likely, it's someone's home movies they brought in by mistake. I'll just go to the back room, fire up the VCR, and all I see is Granny's dentures coming out her mouth into a birthday cake or a dad in a Speedo screaming while going down a hot metal slide. That's all. I may even get some laughs."
He tried convincing himself, but Rex still had a tinge of fear causing his neck to get red hot. Rex went into the back room of the store and inserted the video into the machine. The screen was black for a few seconds, then static. The static faded into a warped picture of inverted and distorted colors. The audio was muffled and hard to hear.
"What am I looking at?"
he started, backing up from the TV.
"Why's the color all messed up?"
Rex stuck his face closer to the screen and squinted.
I think I see something. Looks like a group of people. Is that Dolly Parton?"
He pressed his ear against the TV speaker.
"Why can't I hear nothing?"
Rex turned up the volume, but as he did, the tape started fast-forwarding on its own, and flashes of blinding light emanated off of his Magnavox. Rex quickly fumbled with his remote and turned the volume back down. The video slowed in speed as the volume lowered. The tape started making a clicking noise in the VCR, and the inverted picture started to flicker. Just then the tape showed a group of people in a cemetery. Although the picture quality was poor, Rex could see silhouettes of what looked like blobs on the screen.
It's some dang shadow people,"
he stammered out. Although it was still hard to hear, Rex noticed the movie's audio was lower and distorted. One of the silhouettes on screen spoke.
I just want to hit something. I want to hit it hard.
Rex's eyes widened again. He raised his eyebrows and his forehead started to sweat. His heart pounded as his stomach tied itself up in mangled up, tangled up knots.
Did that thing just say it wants to hit something? Maybe someone? Is there someone in this video about to have harm done to them? Oh no.
Rex had a moment of realization as the tape continued to play. One of the other shadowy figures on the screen grabbed another of the blurry people and spoke.
Here, hear this. Go ahead, my little slapper.
It demanded.
Oh God, this is a snuff film,
Rex blurted out. He stumbled over to the VCR to eject the tape, but the lights in the room started to buzz and pulse off and on.
What kind of evil have I unleashed watching this tape?
Rex cried out. He rushed to grab an Amy Grant poster hanging on the wall behind a cart TV was on.
I gotta make the cross she's wearing visible to whatever demons now reside here.
The lights continued to buzz and flash. The VCR then started to burn hot. The television fluctuated audio speeds in the movie, and Rex anticipated Satan himself to come through the screen. While backing up holding the Amy Grant poster over his head, reciting the lyrics to her 1992 chart-topping hit Good For Me, Rex Wise tripped over a clumping of cords and cables. He fell down right beside the video cart and halfway expected the large television to fall on top of him. However, at the moment he thought he was done for, he saw the abundance of plugs he had in the wall.
Wait a second,
he said as he crawled over to the electrical hazard.
Let me try something.
Rex started frantically, pulling plugs from extenders coming from the outlet. He pulled the plug connecting to VCR, and the video stopped. The tape stopped clicking, and the machine started cooling down. He pulled the plug from the TV, and that turned off. After unplugging a few more things, the lights faded on again, and everything was quiet.
I really should get an extension cord,
a relieved Rex Wise whispered. Rex Wise was never heard from again.
Woohoo! What a story! The one place you feel like you'd always be safe, your local video store. I wasn't expecting that ending either.
Yes, like with any good horror story, you must keep your head on a swivel.
Was it ever revealed what was on the videotape?
Some have said it was a life-altering VHS, riddled with unspeakable terror. But most people believe it was just a bad copy of Steel Magnolias. Anyway, one bad copy we won't be dealing with is the subject of today's episode.
Not long after the brutality of Part 3, another group of hapless souls take up residence close to Crystal Lake. However, after the typical brutality ensues and Jason gets a taste of his own medicine, this time his light may get snuffed out for good. It's Friday the 13th, the final chapter. Stay tuned, boys and ghouls. The Radcast will be right back.
Where's that, that fancy corkscrew for the wine bottle? Ted? Ted, hey, Ted, where the hell's the corkscrew?
Scary.
I don't know how much more of these stories I can take.
Two more stories.
Yes.
Yes, that means after this
it
episode...
It is not the final chapter for Jesco and Chauncey.
And it's not the final chapter for us, but it is the final chapter, supposedly, of one Jason Voorhees for today's episode. Welcome back into the Radcast, everybody. I'm Steven.
I'm Matt.
And thank you again for joining us for yet another week, the 5 weeks of Fright.
Yes.
If you listened last week, you heard us talk about Friday the 13th, Part 3
in
3D. In 3D. That episode came to you in glorious 3D.
Hope you had your glasses handy.
Yes, exactly. Ooh. But this week, they are back to just regular old 2D.
Yeah.
For Friday the 13th, the final chapter, or Part 4, as it's known to some folks.
And this episode will be coming out on Friday the 13th.
That's true. That's exciting because...
That's crazy.
One of the reasons, like we said in the first episode of 5 Weeks of Fright, the main reason we chose to do parts 2, 3, 4, and 6 of Friday the 13th was because there is a Friday the 13th in October this year.
Perfect.
Yes, and part 4, which is the favorite of many people for very good reason.
I was going to say for good reason. If it's not number 1 on a lot of people's lists, it's for sure number 2.
Exactly. So if for very good reason, that one, deservedly so, is coming out on Friday the 13th.
Yep.
So that is exciting.
And very much mucho excited.
Yes. And so far as our schedule goes for the rest of this month, we're going to have a little break from the Friday the 13th films that we've been talking about when we dive into another six mix.
A Halloween spooky six mix.
We have loved doing the six mixes.
Yes.
And with our guest, we will spare no expense with our holiday-themed six mix.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get into Friday the 13th, the final chapter, Matt, why don't you let everyone know where they, not just in October, but where they can always find us.
You can always find us on social media. On Instagram, we are at the Radcast, cast spelled with a K. Radcast is all one word. And then as far as podcast apps go, you name it, we're on it.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know.
Unless there's any more defunct ones that I don't know about.
Yeah. But, you know. You're all tech savvy.
Yeah.
If your podcast app of choice is, you know, goes the way of the dinosaurs, then you just find another one.
Mm-hmm.
Or you just stop listening to podcasts, which, what a sorry existence if that's the case.
Yeah, what a sorry existence.
Sorry!
Yeah, it'll go the way of the dinosaurs, and it'll go the way of Boy Meets World and Perfect Strangers and any other TGIF show.
Any other just TV show that went off the air.
Yeah, not all TV shows remain on forever. However, that's what it looks like The Simpsons are trying to do.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Wherever, on any podcast app, if you can rate and review, please make sure to help us, or do that, please.
Mm-hmm.
Give us 5 stars.
Please.
Give us a review. It really helps us out.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Spotify, we'll somehow find the ability to open up that Q&A section of it.
Sure.
If you would like. But, you know, why wait until then?
Yeah.
If you got the Qs, we got the As.
Yeah.
Just drop in our DMs and... give us a little cue.
Yeah, please slide into our DMs.
Slide.
Slippity slide.
Yeah.
Little cues. Kiss starts with Q. We want the little cues.
Ooh.
So let's talk about Friday the 13th, the final chapter, shall we?
Yeah.
Because I know that's why you all are here and you don't want to hear us.
Let's start talking about something. Because us talking about nothing is stupid.
Yeah, exactly. These two hillbilly morons tell stories and these two regular speaking morons just blather on.
Yeah.
So let's talk about a brutish moron.
Yes.
Friday the 13th's own Jason Voorhees.
Yes.
So it was released April 13th, 1984, which is this is the first time since the first one that the actual events of the movie are taking place the year the movie came out.
Oh, okay.
Because two happened 5 years after the first one. But it came out in 1981, but it was supposed to be taking place in 1984, and three took place a day after the events of two, and this is starting to take place. It starts a day after.
Yeah, the timeline.
Yeah.
It gets weird with one of the characters' motivations, and we'll explain why.
Yeah. But this comes out on a Friday the 13th on April 13th, 1984, directed by Joseph Zito, starring Kimberly Beck as Trish, Corey Feldman, the Feld Dog, as Tommy.
Yeah.
Eric Anderson as Rob. Judy Aronson as Sam. Clyde Haynes as Paul. Peter Barton as Doug. Barbara Howard as Sarah. Crispin Glover as Jim. Lawrence Monison as Ted. Camilla and Carrie Moore as Tina and Terry. Joan Freeman as
Mrs. twins.
As their twins.
British twins.
British
inexplicably.
Twins. Yeah. Well, I don't know if the characters are supposed to be British.
Oh, they're just not good actors.
They're not good at hiding their accents.
Gotcha.
And
Roger.
Roger and his other...
To quote a droid from The Phantom Menace, Roger.
Yes, exactly. Or Roger and his other brother, Roger. Joan Freeman as Mrs. Jarvis and Ted White as Jason. A box office of $32.9 million on a $2.6 million budget. Oh my God, I forgot to get a VHS open. Well.
We had Jessica and Chauncey. We had enough VHS.
Yeah, they already talked about a VHS. Sorry for veering from the regular segment.
Yeah.
To be honest, though, there isn't a VHS open for this movie on YouTube.
It's YouTube's fault.
No,
it's not yours.
Whenever we can't find a VHS open, I do like to supplement that. But I just...
I just plumb forgot. You know, this time around, it's fine.
It's
We make up for it somehow. You're doing fine, Chris.
Yeah.
So one of the things, I mean, the movie opens up. It's takes place.
It's very cinematic.
Oh, yeah. It takes place the day after, like pretty much the night after the events happened. It kind of, as far as continuity goes, as we mentioned in 3, the end of that is Chris, ultimately Chris Higgins, being taken out in a hysterical state by authorities. This one opens and it's nighttime. Yeah. I'm going to guess the authorities did not arrive, like EMTs and ambulances and the rest of the police force and the little helicopter with the searchlight that we open up on. I'm guessing they didn't get there until the evening that they took Chris away. Either way, it happens a day after the events of 3. But unlike the way 3 opened up, this has some production value behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely an intent here. They're like, I almost, the term that kept coming to mind was pulling out all the stops.
Oh, yeah.
And not just in terms of like the framing of this opening, but like, when they brought, we brought Tom Savini back from the, who did the makeup effects on the first movie, and the kills are especially grisly in this one and creative and stuff like that. And this Jason is quick and he moves fast and like he's especially like
barbaric.
So there's definitely a sense of finality to it. And I think this has sort of, I don't want to say a big fight feel, but
you know, you can tell they wanted to up the prestige in certain ways.
Yeah, and everyone listening, you obviously know this isn't the last one.
Right, exactly. But that's why it's kind of frustrating with this one, because
it would have been a good ending.
It would have been a very good ending. They bookend it by showing, you know, like I said, they had this big crane shot of this searchlight coming off of a helicopter, and the camera does this tracking, following ambulances driving in and out of frame.
It feels like a big deal.
Exactly. Yeah. It's rainy. It's wet outside. You have police officers in ponchos and people taking evidence and you know, carting off bodies. And but the main people in the scene of all of this, you know, this eventful stuff going, like all of the buzzing going on and all this stuff happening at this cleanup effort of the slayings in 3. We follow these EMTs driving in an ambulance, and they are there to get Jason, who has just been laying there. And again, if we're going off the logic of like he's been there the whole time, like Chris was taken away earlier in the day and then more authorities came.
Yeah.
Like, I think that really kind of hammers home, you know, at the beginning here, he's dead.
Yeah, because he could, because if 2 or the beginning of 3 told us anything, he can just get up and walk away.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if he wasn't dead, he would just got up and walk away. So you're like, oh, he's dead.
Yeah.
I mean, he was an audience member. Mm-hmm. No, he's not. But within the context of the movie, if you're a character in the movie, you're like, oh, he's dead.
Yeah. And some of the earlier fake outs to build suspense are like one of the EMTs is skittish. Yeah. Whenever, you know, she's around the body, it's obviously this person who just killed a bunch of people over the course of 2 and 3.
Yeah.
And the kind of the lead veteran EMTs, like, you know, like Jason's arm falls out after they've covered it up and put him on a gurney.
Like,
and he's like, hey, belt him. He's like, he's dead. Like, get over, like, it's our, like, compose yourself. He's dead. Belt him. Like, put the belt over him.
Yeah.
They get it in they get it inside of the back of the ambulance, and everybody's driving off, and you know, the first 5 minutes of the movie, it's all this hustle and bustle, and these you know, it's dark outside, but it's everything's illuminated by the searchlight and by patrol cars and the lights on top of the authority, the like ambulance and the police cars, and it's all this stuff, and the final shot again, it's back to this overhead crane shot of Higgins Haven, which they went back to just for this sole purpose. And it's all of these vehicles leaving the scene on their way to their next location, like to the hospital to put Jason in the morgue. And after that, you see the last car disappear behind the horizon. It's completely dark.
Yeah.
And Joseph Zito had them stay on Higgins Haven.
Yeah.
And all you hear at that point are the sounds of nature, and it's this odd juxtaposition of this serenity of just this serene spot in the woods.
Oh, yeah.
Normally, after all of, you would use the word grisly, after all of these grisly murders that have happened. And it's just, the scariest part is that we're now at peace, if only for a second, in a spot to where all of this horror just went down. And you, as the audience, are left there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, although Jason's in a on his way to the morgue, like, you're left there and you've been conditioned that a dark, wooded area.
This is not good.
Yeah, this is not good. But then they quickly go to Jason being brought into the hospital. Yeah. And there's some very, you mentioned cinematic. There's very cinematic and sophisticated like shots.
The shot of Axel watching the women on TV.
Yes, exactly. And I know it's strange to hear words like sophisticated and intelligent
when talking about an 80s slasher movie.
However, I think there needs to be props given, not just to the effort. I mean, of course, we've given props to the special effects efforts and what's gone into some of the killings, and then the great Tom Savini and his effects.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we've given kudos here and there, but just with horror movies in general, if you get past all of, you know, the sex and the violence and the some of the more criticized aspects of horror movies, there's some acumen behind a lot of them. You know, whether it's the director of photography, whether it's the cinematographer, whether it's the director themselves, whether it's the script, whether it's performances, there's a lot of good in a lot of horror movies. And this is no exception to that rule, but also it sets itself apart from the first three.
Yeah, and you get that when there's a sense of, we recognize what genre we're in and kind of what's expected, but that doesn't mean that we still can't take certain elements of it seriously, you know, because we're making a movie.
Yeah.
And so it's like, we still can tell a story. Mm-hmm. We can still do this. We can still do that. And by this point, it like, we are full on, especially with it being, quote unquote, the last one, people want to see, like, everyone making the movie wanted to see how grisly and gruesome they can make the kills. And it's one of those things that, as a viewer, it's tough to express without someone thinking that you're completely morbid.
Right.
But I think it more has to do with an appreciation for, like, the ingenuity and the creativity of the effects artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a fascination with horror and things that are frightening, and I've always seen it as a weird line to walk.
Yeah.
But a movie starts and you're in this world that's being established, and you get to somewhat indulge in fear. You know, that's an emotion that we express, but not to sound redundant, but we're afraid of it.
Yeah.
You know, people say I can't speak for other people, but I don't like to be scared.
No, I don't either.
But within a movie, it's a controlled environment, and there's an element of fantastical sort of fantasy. Like, you're not fantasizing about it, but there's a fantasy element to it. So I think that makes it easier to kind of welcome that, and I think that's a lot of people's allure to horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
I know you didn't ask, but that was one of those things to where it's always, because I was watching this and I was watching Crystal Lake Memories and I could never articulate. It's like, why do people like horror movies? Like, it's been explained to me, but it's still, there's a disconnect when I'm like, for me, it's like I said, it's a controlled environment.
Mm-hmm.
I know what is happening isn't real.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it easier. And so because you are safe in this environment, it's easier to kind of let your guard down and allow yourself to be scared, sort of thing. And this movie acknowledges that more than the other three.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, we're going to just kind of full steam ahead with it and just give it, you know, a sense of finality, like I said before.
We've reserved some of our more gruesome killings for this. We're giving... You know, Tom Savini, this playground, you know, we're giving him all these tools, you know, kid in the candy store, and you can get whatever you want. Like, that doesn't mean the MPAA didn't have their say.
No.
There's extended versions of all of these deaths that make it look more gruesome, but they do stay on them long enough to where I think
It's unsettling.
Yeah. I was watching four. I watched it twice. One of them has a director's commentary, and it's the director of the Hatchet movies.
Okay.
Which is that's the type of horror I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Oh yeah,
like,
I do have a line.
I was like yeah. But there's the purpose behind it, and the cult following those movies have of just the unbelievably ultra violent,
yeah,
and just crosses the line of,
yeah,
like, God, all right, I get it. He's killing that person.
Mm-hmm.
God Almighty. Like,
yeah.
But it's like this blood feast, and you know,
yeah,
they have their fans for various reasons.
Yeah.
But,
given the rationalization,
yeah,
I just gave.
Yeah.
There's still a disconnect with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Like, I respect creativity and ingenuity,
mm-hmm,
but, like, pretty much this movie and, like, the ensuing ones and the,
mm-hmm,
ones, kind of like this stuff is kind of where I draw the line.
Yeah.
When it gets, like, the Hatchet movies and all that stuff, it gets to be too much.
Yeah.
You're like, I know it's not real. The makeup, the effects artists were having fun.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone on set. Kind of like the actors, Tom Savini said, like, the actors want to be killed,
yeah,
in grisly ways.
Like, how am I going to die?
That's,
how are you going to kill me?
For them,
because, mm-hmm,
they know the, you know, what these movies are about. But that just gets to a point where, like, it is just so over the top,
yeah,
and ridiculous. It's like, I can't watch that.
Yeah. But it was a commentary with the director of
Hatchet.
But
they have their fans, like,
yeah,
you,
yeah,
said.
And then another director. And they were talking about what was kind of great about the movie, things they liked about it, because they've seen it a million more times than we have.
Yeah.
But one of the things the director of Hatchet said was, sure, you know, you have, I think, horror fans, and I think this commentary maybe came out in, like, 2000, the late 2000s.
Yeah.
But he was like, you have the horror fans now who want, like, these bloodbaths, and they want these prolonged, like, gory moments.
Yeah.
They really just have this hunger for just uber gore, and so they watch something like this and they say, oh, come on, give us more,
yeah,
give us more gore, give us more gore.
Yeah.
But in that moment, of course, the MPAA thought so, but he's like, in that moment, he's like, I feel like the kills were on there just long enough,
yeah,
to be like, oh man, but he's like,
yeah,
I feel it's more impactful that way,
because,
yeah, you don't have something like that overstaying its welcome,
yeah,
to the horror fan.
Yeah, it becomes, I think what it is it's overkill.
Yeah.
And I'm not a huge fan of anything that overdoes something.
Yeah.
Or is overkill. And it's like,
mm-hmm,
okay, it's like you said, we get it. Jesus, mm-hmm, Christ, we get it.
Yeah. So he was like, so I think it actually plays in its favor that the impact of the kill, especially,
mm-hmm,
like, you know, high impact kills,
yeah,
from Jason, you know, that's where they're more effective, is because,
yeah,
they're not on screen so long that the audience is like, okay. Okay,
yeah,
I get it.
Yeah.
I mean, timing and rhythm is everything.
It's just enough to be effective.
Yeah.
Be like, oosh.
Yeah.
I'm that's going to stick with me kind,
yeah,
of thing.
And for those of you curious, I don't know if you took note of all the kills, like,
yes,
you haven't. Okay,
mm-hmm,
so we'll go over those,
yep,
here in a little bit. But also, one of the things that I really like about 4 is it's shot differently.
Yeah.
Like, I know we mentioned some of the shots are more cinematic, and it looks like, not just a movie, but like a film.
A suspense.
Yeah.
Like a suspense film.
Yeah, like,
yeah,
like, yeah, if that makes sense out there. Like, but to me,
yeah,
it doesn't look like
the previous ones kind of had a B.
They looked
like
low budget.
An 80s B low budget kind of,
yeah,
grain to them.
Yeah, which is fine. It's kind of these, although they came out in the early 80s, there's,
yeah,
still these dashes of the 70s in,
yeah,
there, whether it's in the style or,
yeah,
again, the type of film they used.
Which,
or,
they are low budget.
Yeah, exactly.
So that
they
explains
are.
That.
They are. But it was in this carryover point of, you know, every decade to decade,
mm-hmm,
has this,
yeah,
carry, this residual time.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was this carryover point from the 70s into the 80s to where these early 80s movies, as do a lot of all the slashers from this time, still have that 70s,
yeah,
kind of look to it. This one was the first one that looked like an 80s movie.
Yeah.
Especially if you're familiar with how, like, John Hughes movies looked.
Yeah, definitely John Hughes-esque kind of teenage characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That the goal, Joseph Zito said, and even reviews said, like, you know, we spent half the movie getting, because he wanted the audience to get to know and develop a connection with the kids. And, you know, there were reviews saying, like, you know, you spend half the movie getting to know and liking these characters, and then the rest of the movie watching them die, which is like, A, that's the point. And B, I'm just going to say all but two are really not likable.
Yeah.
Like, Doug and Sarah are the only ones that are, like, likable.
And
everyone
in the group,
else kind of sucks.
Like, because, like, you
have... Even Crispin Glover.
He is so pathetic
he's
in
such
this movie.
A loser.
Like, there was a scene to where...
Like, you're supposed to feel bad for him, but you're just like, oh, my God, what are you complaining about now?
Yeah. So, that was my exact reaction. So, 35 minutes into the movie, we've already... The balance is great between the teens, and also there's a new element, because there's a family.
We spent a good amount of time with them. The problem is their goal is to get us to like them, but I don't like any of them except two.
Yeah. I think also that's where the power of the John Hughes-esque, like, or the John Hughes-esque, like the John Hughes-y 80s characters.
Back, like, kind of back and forth.
Especially between
Ted
Jim
and Jimmy.
And Ted.
Yeah.
And the 80s sensibilities we're now in with the 80s aesthetics. Yeah. Like, there's of course, endearment and charm in that.
Yeah.
But if you get past that, like...
Yeah.
I don't know if you thought someone like Teddy would be likable. He's not.
Which the guy that played Ted, what was his name?
Lawrence Monison.
Lawrence Monison. A couple years prior, he was in The Last American Virgin. I hate that movie. Which is an 80s teen sex comedy.
Yeah.
So he's kind of got that experience
with
that. And you know him from that if you watch this movie.
There's
that
little
movie.
Like... flash of sleaze on the guy.
God,
and then,
I hate
and
that
then,
movie.
And then Crispin Glover is, again, he's such a wimp.
He's a spazzy, pathetic wimp.
Yeah. But in this movie, one of the, probably outside of some of the kills and, you know, how Jason dies, I'd say the most notable thing is the scene 35 minutes in. So at this point, we are introduced to the first people we see on screen. Oof, man, I just remember we got to go backwards for a second. So when Jason's in the morgue, there's these great moments.
Yeah.
Because we would be remiss to not talk a little bit about Axel and the aerobics video, but also like another fake out and then how the audience sees Jason still alive.
Yeah.
So they're in the morgue.
Which is a nice touch.
Yeah, there's this really flippant morgue worker, Axel, who it's the rabbi
from
Seinfeld.
Oh, yeah.
Let me tell you something, Elaine.
Yeah. Okay. I like him more just for that, but the character's a sleazeball.
Yeah, he's also
also
in the Police Academy movies.
Yes.
But he's this sleazy kind of flippant morgue worker who like he's resting a sandwich on top of Jason's body He's like, oh, that's a cute girl over there. And yeah, well, she's dead. Still cute, like it was just like ugh. But
why is anyone attracted to you? Why is that nurse attracted?
But the lead ambulance driver was also Jerry's barber in Seinfeld.
Oh,
he had put his hands.
Yeah,
it was beautiful.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he's like, why don't you show a little respect here? And they're rolling their eyes at Axel, and then they leave, and then Axel's hitting on this nurse, and she obviously doesn't want his advances, but somehow he wins
her
over.
Then she accepts them. I'm like, what is it about this guy?
And they start they're about to start making love, and Jason's body is right there. But he's seen as like, you know, he's this silly, goofy, you know, like funny character. Whatever. He stands out. His character stands out. He's a fan favorite.
You remember his appearance. Yeah. It was short.
Yeah,
so he did his job.
Yeah. And while they're about to make love, Jason's arm comes down again and hits the nurse in the leg, and she freaks out. And you better get that thing into the ice box.
Yeah,
she does have a very distinct
Midwest accent.
Yeah. And it also this is also
Minnesota
or
North Dakota. Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a little twang.
Yeah,
to it.
Exactly.
Ah,
like elongating those vowels.
Ah.
Yep, that was her screaming.
Yeah.
ice box. You didn't get that thing into the ice box. I told him to. Now it's alive.
Go Bears!
Go Bears!
R.I.P. Dick Butkus.
Yeah. R.I.P. Dick Butkus.
R.I.P. Dick Butkus. Anyway.
I thought you were hilarious as a kid because your last name was Butkus.
Yep. Well, anyway. So Axel, You know, he ruins his chances with the nurse that he's accosting, but he's watching this aerobics video, which people think is strange.
Yeah.
And then as he's pushing Jason into the morgue cooler.
Well, he's a perv, and the ladies are like wearing, you know, tight fitting clothes and like bending down and all that stuff.
Yes. Yes. He's a pervert.
He's a sleazeball.
Yeah. So he pushes Jason into the morgue cooler, and right as he's closing the door, you see a puff of air come up from beneath the sheet.
Real brief, but it's very great. It's a great touch.
Yeah, and then Jason takes a hacksaw and cuts his head and like twists it, which you'll get into, and then he kills the nurse. But then after that, we see what we haven't seen before, and that is a mother and a daughter, which means there's a family.
It's a wholesome family dynamic. The Jarvis family.
Tina and her mom, and then, Trish and her mom, and then we will see another first for the series at this point, a child character with the one, Corey Feldman, as one
a tiny child.
Exactly, yeah.
Sorry, Willow.
As a fan favorite, Tommy Jarvis.
Yeah.
So we see him, and then we see the teenager characters as well, and they converge because the Jarvis house is across.
It's like right next to it.
Yeah, it's right next to the house of the teenagers.
Yeah. Trish is like, you know, any word on if someone's going to be in that house next to us? And I think her mom's like, oh, you know, some kids who are like renting it out or something. I don't know if they're there for like a week or the weekend. They don't say.
Yeah. But we see.
But you think people would stop going by Camp Crystal Lake, especially when these events have happened within a few days of each other.
But the thing is, how many kids at that point, especially teenagers,
are even paying attention?
Are paying attention to the news?
Yeah, that's
true. You're not going to get an alert on your phone or something like that happening.
Even with it being in the paper, because like they show mom looking at the paper, kids aren't going to read the paper.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, we've got this trip planned and we're just going to go. We're just going to go.
Yeah, exactly. But the Jarvises are out there, and we are introduced to Tommy Jarvis,
Corey Feldman,
and he's a likable little scamp who all he wants to do, he's excited about the teenagers getting there because all that's out there, him, his dog, his mom, his sister,
and his like little projects he does up in his room. He's an aspiring makeup effect. Like he does, like he creates masks and he creates like special effects and all that stuff.
He's playing a video game while wearing an alien mask.
Yeah, exactly. Which, I mean, obviously you don't think that Tommy's gonna be an alien, but I said it'd be funny if for the rest of them if he actually was an alien, like, and no one drew attention to it,
like Meatballs 2.
Yeah
I think in Fangoria, this was also said in the commentary by the director of Hatchet, I think at that time, you know, him being an avid reader of Fangoria magazine, there was a picture in there of Tommy with the alien mask,
no one
on
had any context,
and he's like, is there gonna be an alien in this movie? But it's cool. He's a fan favorite because of, you know, right out of the gate, we see him playing a video game and his mom's asking, he's wearing a mask and she's like, is that your new mask? And like,
you're getting good at this.
Yeah. He's also getting hassled by his mom to get a haircut. And then later we see, you know, he's the analog for the young audience who, when he sees one of the naked teenage young adult characters, he starts having a conniption fit
flipping
in his bed.
Out.
With the same gusto he had killing Jason.
Yeah,
spoiler alert.
The little boy kills Jason.
But we're introduced to these characters, and then, you know, the classic driving in the car to your cabin, to wherever they're going in the woods. We meet the teenagers, and one of the teenagers, Sarah, looks out the window, and it's the first time in the series we know Mrs. Voorhees' name is Pamela, because she sees her headstone on the side of the road, which I think is a nice little touch. It's another addition for the finality of the series. But they all converge, and like Trish and Tommy go and meet them and whatever. They all seem, it's not like in Seven where there's this needless animosity. Needless animosity. It's like Gwyneth Paltrow's head gets put in a box.
Yeah.
But it's not in Part Seven where like someone like Tina, who meets these other, she's this outsider character who meets these other teenagers, and a lot of them kind of,
they're kind of bitchy
towards her for whatever reason. Everybody seems to like one another. But one of the things this movie does really well is it takes these two sets of characters that could easily muddle up.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to say the plot, because there's really not a plot. No. But it's easily muddle up what you're trying to do with trying to focus on these characters, if the intent was to make them likable, they balance it really well.
Yeah. They're like, oh, they're not being mean to mm-hmm. Trish. Trish is our main girl, you know? Yeah. And they're not being mean to her. So for that, it's like, oh, they're not so bad. Yeah. Even though the more time we spend with them, they're like, they're not great either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, we go back and forth between the Jarvis family yeah. and the teenagers. And I would like to mention,
yes,
on the way there, when with the first interaction we see between Jimbo and yeah. Ted, is Jim's like, I did everything right. I can't believe she broke up with me. I was there for her. I'm a Woody Allen now.
Yeah, I was there for her. I don't know what we're doing. I'm the guy from the third one.
Oh, yes, I was there for her. I don't understand.
Yeah,
for a girl named Blowjob Betty, how come I couldn't get any love?
But basically, he's lamenting about. Yeah. He's like, I was blood. Betty, you know.
It's like, I did everything right with Betty. He's like, you broke up with Blowjob Betty. And like,
yeah.
And it's there's a lot more dialogue in here that is more akin to like the John
like
Hughes
teenagers
movies that
in the 80s.
Yeah.
Talking
yeah.
To each other.
The quote, the sex comedies of yeah. the 80s, but which infused more of the 80s
yeah.
kind
Ted,
of sensibilities.
Ted starts typing on a box of beer or whatever, like it's a computer. He's like, let me put it in the computer. It says here.
What does it say?
What does it say? It says you're a dead fuck.
It's like, a dead fuck?
It's like, a dead fuck?
A dead fuck?
He's you like, know, that's what that's just Crispin Glover being eccentric.
Yeah, he's like, give it to, no, don't hold back on me. Give it to me straight, Doc. He's like, that's yeah. what the computer says. He's like, there is no computer. He's like, yeah. yes, and there is no Betty.
Yeah, apparently that was improvised
yeah.
by the two of them.
Whatever.
Who
I don't
cares?
I don't feel like the two of them are smart enough to improvise that.
No.
But then again, it's not really smart dialogue, so maybe
no,
they did. I don't
probably.
Know. I don't know. Yo, hey, what's going on?
Hey, oh, hey. Andrew
but,
Dice Clay.
Yeah, exactly. He did a lot of jokes like that.
Anyway.
But that's one of the more...
That's one of the more famous lines.
Yeah.
A dead fuck.
And it establishes those two characters, who are two of... They have probably the most notable back and forth between the teens.
Yeah.
Everybody else kind of takes it.
Meaning that he can't get it up.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
He sucks.
Mm-hmm.
He sucks at sex.
Yep. But we see them, and then we see the events of what they're doing involved. Like, they're walking, you know, along a trail, and they meet
yeah.
these two twins who... Where did they come from?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When the teens are walking up the trail, they're heading up to Crystal Point.
Yeah.
And, yeah, these twins just come barreling in on their bicycles. Not like, I can't stop. Slow down. Yeah, get out of the way. But they pull up and they're like, hey, how's it going? You know, mm-hmm. and Crispin Glover's like, are you all from around here? And they didn't answer the question.
Yeah.
They never answered. They just say.
Like, is someone talking?
Yeah. They're like, we're going up to Crystal Point. And like, that's where we're going. It's a long walk or whatever. Apparently, they're not supposed to be British. This is news to me.
Mm-hmm.
But the actresses are British.
Yeah.
And then that's where we get those characters. And they go up to Crystal Point and start skinny dipping.
Yep. There's skinny dipping. That's where we see Trish and Tommy encounter them again. And Tommy's like, whoa, boobies.
As Corey Feldman would say in his interview in Crystal Lake Memories, boobies.
Yeah, that's how he still is now.
Yeah, exactly.
Forever in Arrested Development.
Yeah, exactly.
But
then the character of Paul, there's a rope swing.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed, but because, you know, they all start skinny dipping, so the guys take their pants, they're all naked and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when Paul swings on the rope, he very clearly... there's not enough clearance,
yeah.
and he slams his ass
uh-huh.
on like the surface just below the water,
uh-huh.
and I think like you can see the actor kind of tilt his head to the sky and like open his mouth, like I think they're trying to convey it like he's like woohoo,
yeah.
but I would not be surprised if the actual audio is him just in absolute pain.
Oh yeah, for sure. But. When they're like, hey, Trish, hey, party tonight. Come on, Trish.
Yeah,
and she's
bring
like,
that kid, too,
yeah,
and that dog.
Make sure you bring that dog.
Yeah.
And then the dog
tells good jokes.
Yeah. But then she pulls Tommy away to, like, go, and then we're with Tommy and Trish, and then that's when they encounter Rob, who's a hitchhiker, or not a hitchhiker. He's a drifter. He's
a
wanderer.
Their car breaks down, and
yeah.
he comes to help them, and he's like, hi, my name's Rob.
Yeah.
She's like, you want a ride?
Yeah.
It's like, Where? It's among also some of the several fake outs at that point, because all we see is our feet, which they're not Rob's feet.
Yeah.
Like if you notice, like those are Jason's feet, but then we see Rob, and it was supposed to be like, maybe it was just not, you know, lack of continuity.
Yeah.
But we see a pair of feet and we hear the Harry Manfredini score.
Yeah.
And
which is used so effectively in this movie, especially in the, I think I have a note in here about how this is the most tense final act pursuit
this one,
the entire series.
Oh,
yeah.
This one does suspense really, really well.
Which is good because it's that sense of finality that we were talking about.
Yeah.
You're and that's pulling out all the stops.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you want to give, you know, kudos to.
Yeah.
If you don't want to focus just on like gore or whatever, this one does suspense really well, which is, that's great context for giving more impact to a kill or to a scare, is the suspense was really good.
Yeah. Once they're, it's literally, you could sum up the rest of what the teens do into like, I have like 7 bullet points.
Yeah.
It's literally teen skinny dip. Paul clearly scrapes his ass on the ground.
Yeah.
Crispin Glover, the spastic dancing scene.
That's, I think, I think all 15 minutes ago, that's what I was trying to get to, but then like revert and backtrack.
Yes.
It, this, all of the balancing of these characters leads up to the start of the party. We see Crispin Glover put on a record and he goes
Would
up to-
Would you like to dance?
He goes up to one of the twins. He's like, Would you like to dance? She's like, to this?
This
and he's
is,
like,
it's good.
He's like, it's good. And then he does.
Actually, we've been giving him shit, but Crispin Glover is Crispin Glovering.
Right.
This, he's an eccentric guy.
He's setting himself apart, which I give him, which I give him all the credit in the world for.
He is one of the most memorable parts of this movie. So the character, yes, is pathetic, but he's also like, there's something that draws you in. He's definitely, like you said, sets himself apart.
Yeah. And like he does this, it's so odd and so out of place, and it's how Crispin Glover would dance in clubs at that time
in real life. But, literally just on YouTube, you can type in Crispin Glover Friday the 13th, and it's probably one of the first videos of him dancing.
You could even post it on Instagram
if
you want.
That's a good idea.
But you see that, and then they revert to slow dancing, and he's hitting it off with one of the twins, so he looks happy.
Yeah.
That's why all the way back again 15 minutes ago when we were like, he's pathetic, and we're like, there's a scene in the kitchen where I'm like, what now? Like, it's this scene to where like we see the Jarvis family again, then we come back, and he's pouting in the kitchen, and like, Teddy comes in and starts giving him crap about being a dead F and all this stuff. But, you know, he's standing there with a scowl on his face, and I literally was like, what now?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, this whole time, he's just been, like, really, like, you know, he's running his hand through his hair and his wrist skittish, and he's like, you know, I want you to stop calling me that. And, like, there is this troubling part to where,
stop calling me that.
Like, Teddy is trying to, like, get it on with one of the other twins.
Yeah.
She likes Paul, whose girlfriend is Samantha, who is one of the more notable deaths in the movie. And, like, of course, Samantha doesn't like this, but, like, one of the twins starts, like, dancing with them, and that's the twin, of course, you know, Ted wants to be with, and Ted's kind of like just sitting on the steps, just like
stewing.
He's stewing. He's like, I'm gonna kill that guy. And Crispin Glover, the way he delivers it, he's like, I want to talk to you.
Yeah.
And he's like, not now, dead F. And he's like, I told you to stop calling me that. I really would like to talk to you. I'm like, is he a red herring? Is he going to kill him? Is he Jason?
Yeah.
Yes, he is. Yeah. And Five had no problem with, spoiler alert, Five had no problem with faking out the audience.
Yes, exactly. So after the dancing scene, it like cuts between.
It was the dancing scene. Dancing scene. It's not me, Joe Green.
Mean Joe Green. So they cut back and forth between Trish stuff, Trish and Tommy and that stuff. And then so after that, they're just chugging beers. And then they slow dance, like you were saying. And then Ted, Sarah, Terry, and Doug, there are too many characters.
Right.
They watch a dirty movie that Ted found. It's like from the 20s. It's a silent movie, but there's exposed boobies. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like that era's version of pornography.
Yeah.
And it's on an old film reel, and they found a projector and all that mm-hmm. stuff. And so it's the four of them watching that. And then, you know, Sarah and Doug excuse themselves. Tina and Jimmy are having sex. So Crispin Glover and one of the other twins mm-hmm. to prove he's not a dead F.
Mm-hmm.
To which she's like, oh, you are incredible or whatever.
And he's like, all right.
Yeah, yippee.
He's like, very nice.
Exactly. And then I just put the rest start dropping like flies.
Yep.
That's when they all start dropping mm-hmm. like flies.
There's a lot. There's not. It's you don't have to wait as long for kills in this movie. They happen more consistently like across the runtime than they have in other movies. And definitely, again, a lot of it doesn't feel rushed in the third act because they've paced it out
mm-hmm.
like the deaths.
Yeah.
And then eventually we get there could be more said about Tommy. They're about because again, like we said earlier, a lot of people who watched the movie and were fans of Tommy started watching them when they were like 10, 11, 12 years old.
Yeah.
Tommy's age in the movies, 12 years old. And it's just, they're like, that, you know, that's me watching this movie.
Yeah.
I'm looking over my shoulder, like, make sure my parents don't walk in with naked women on the screen or with this violence going on.
Yeah.
But my favorite interpretation of Corey Feldman's performance was Ted White.
Oh,
who
yes.
hated Corey Feldman.
Yeah, Ted White, who played Jason.
The oldest stuntman to ever play Jason, but he was 58 years old, but before that, he was a legend. Like a legendary stuntman in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And he was embarrassed by the film because he's like, you know, I've been a stuntman for Cary Grant and John Wayne and like all these people. And, you know, I'm highly respected of what I do.
Yeah.
And you're caking all this makeup on me. I like Tom Savini, but this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And he grew to love it. But one thing,
you
know, he said this is the best group of teen actors I ever worked with.
But
he hated Corey Feldman.
I wanted to kill him desperately.
He was like, he was the goddamnedest bastard.
He was a mean little devil. I wanted to kill him desperately.
Which is one of my favorite lines from Crystal Lake Memories. I laugh every time.
I
wanted
to kill him desperately. There's a few other lines where he's talking about during Doug's kill.
Yeah.
He's like, my hands are my weapons. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I can get in real good and kill him.
There's this gleam in his eye.
I always like to pretend that he thinks they're not filming. He's talking about actually, it's the same thing where he's talking about the scene where he pursues Trish. He's like, I loved chasing after the girl. Like that got me going.
Her screams invigorated me.
Yeah. To which it sounds really weird.
Uh-huh.
I doubt he meant anything weird by it, but I just love the idea of him talking candidly, thinking he's talking off camera. I think you were at one point, because I texted you.
Yeah.
At one point, you're like, all right, you can roll the film,
ask your questions. And everyone's just like, bug-eyed.
What?
I think he's since passed Crystal Lake Memories. But he is one of the favorite Jasons because of
the way he moves is really
before
really
Kane Hodder
good.
Really brought characteristics you can point to, oh, that's Kane Hodder's Jason. Ted White kind of made Jason, you know, set apart from the other ones.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely his stunt experience was put him over other ones just in the little movements he would make sort of thing.
We have some more instances where we see Rob. Again, the drifter or the man walking through the woods. It's revealed he's out to kill Jason.
Because Jason killed his sister, Sandra,
mm-hmm.
which within the timeline of the movie, Sandra was in the second one.
Mm-hmm.
In the timeline of the movie, that happened a few days ago.
Yeah, how would he know? How long has he been? I don't know.
That's the other
plot
thing. Like, how long has he been? They're making it seem like, oh, I've been searching far and wide and been on Jason's trail for a long time. When really, like, his sister died like 3 days ago.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe that it's conceivable at that time. It could have been a little bit. It could have been a while before he found out that she even died. So it's like, that's where a hole kind of comes in the plot.
But him encountering the Jarvises, there is the scene where, you said Trish gives him a ride, and you're like, ride where? But it ends up, she takes him back to her house and her mom's confused as to who this stranger is, which rightfully so. But yeah. Tommy is excited to show someone his inventions. So one of the better parts of the movie to really show, you know, Tommy's flair for this, you know, invention and to create, you know, he's named Tommy because Tom Savini.
Yeah.
But he's brought up, Tommy brings Rob up to his room and he shows him like this monster animatronic he's working on that he puppets and he shows it, like Rob's looking around and he's like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Like all these
masks.
You're
just a little kid.
Yeah, exactly. So that's another reason people are like, he's this nerdy kid who gets to see boobies. Like, you know, I relate to him.
Yeah. It's the kids. It's like you said, it's the kid who's watching these movies at a sleepover.
Yeah.
Or, you know, late at night while his parents are asleep. Mm-hmm. Like, previous like slasher movies and previous Friday the 13th, it's like, this is when I get to see boobies.
Yeah.
And now there's a character that represents them.
And then, of course, you know, Rob ends up not being the final hero. And even Trish holds her own when she's being pursued by Jason. Like, she's very, very physical.
Yeah. And throughout the movie, she is, it's not like she's like super, like stands up to people or
she's
anything.
She's just reserved.
You know, she just hangs out with her mom and her little brother mostly kind of thing.
And it's one of those things where you're like,
but
you
she's
know,
protective of her
she
brother.
She is. And that really comes through. But in the final part of the movie, she knocks Jason's mask off after having a tussle with him because she got him off the ground and off of her because Tommy uses his head and he's like, I'm going to make myself look like Jason when he was a kid, according to the newspaper clippings that Rob had been holding on to, this sketch of Jason with like this tufts of hair, or this bald kid with tufts of hair. Over.
Yeah.
So, you know, essentially Tommy shaves his head and he uses, you know, psychological tactics. So he's like, Jason,
it's after me, Jason. This intense pursuit
in the rain,
Jason versus Trish. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's the most intense one they've created so far because he's in such the houses are in close proximity to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time Trish discovers Jason and Jason kills Rob and all that stuff, like he's just a few steps behind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like being in a bad dream.
Yeah.
And you're like trying to desperately get away and like, you feel it. It's you're on the edge of your seat.
And you have the moment where a body gets thrown through the window. It's Rob after he's killed. And then the part that made Ted White the most gleeful he's ever been on a movie is there's a scene where Trish is like down near Rob's body. And then at the other window, Tommy's backing up towards it. And Jason comes through and grabs him, which purposefully Ted White did not come in on cue because Corey Feldman would have expected it.
Yeah.
He wanted
to scare the shit out of him.
So Corey Feldman thought, was there something wrong with the cue or whatever?
Yeah.
If there's a delay. And then Ted White came through and genuinely
that
scared
genuine
the hell out
fear
of him. Yeah,
that
exactly.
What you're seeing. And then when they back off, because Trish comes in with the back end of a hammer, just smacking the smacking, you know, Jason in the head.
Mm-hmm.
And when they back off and Ted White busts through the door, I want to kill you desperately.
You just get that sound bite.
Yeah.
Where's the boy? I want to kill him desperately.
Yeah. But
just give me the boy. I'll spare you.
Yeah. When they cut to the look on Corey Feldman's face, in his interview, Corey Feldman's like, that's genuine fear.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually, like, every part of my body was scared.
I'm just thinking of, what's up with you? What's up with you?
Corey Feldman's successful music career.
I could go on a whole different diatribe about Corey Feldman. I will preface and say, I know you could say, well, he's gone through a lot, man. He has. He definitely has gone through a lot, and I am totally sensitive towards that. However,
but he's done enough as an adult the last decade.
As an adult.
Be like, okay, I can't excuse.
He's done and said some pretty scummy things.
Yeah.
But that's new. We're not talking about Corey Feldman. If you want a Fell Dog episode, just let us know, and we'll do a Corey Feldman episode.
Exactly.
But at this point now, it's just, you know, Tommy, again, back to the final confrontation, and Tommy he's got Jason vulnerable and confused, and Trish turns around and hits Jason in the face with the machete, knocks his mask off, and we see just this grotesque looking face.
Yeah.
And then he's about to start attacking Trish, and Tommy picks up the machete and like puts it through Jason's head, and the most famous Friday kill, it rivals the sleeping bag kill in part 7.
Yeah.
But the most famous one is the machete gets stuck in Jason's head, but
falls
that,
forward.
That's not all. He falls forward, and this is Tom Savini animatronic puppet. Yeah. He's controlling. Falls forward, and I'm sorry for if this is too graphic for some listeners, but essentially it hits him in the head. And his head slides down the blade down of the machete.
Yeah.
And that's it for Jason. Until Tommy and Trish are
hugging. Tommy sees his fingers moving.
Tommy and Trish are hugging, and sees his fingers moving. And Tommy, which is Corey Feldman, just hitting a machete against potato sacks.
Yeah.
Or it was against something.
Yeah.
And he's like, die!
Which
die!
Sounds so stupid.
Yeah, it does.
Because it's coming out of Corey Feldman's pipsqueak mouth.
Oh, here's it's the news lady.
Yeah,
from
it's Ninja Turtles. From Ninja Turtles. It's him trying to sound badass.
Yeah.
And he's a kid.
Yeah. And then the
kids
end.
Kids don't sound badass.
Yeah. And like Trish is in a hospital bed,
yeah.
And the police are explaining, you know, he's in great moments of distress, you know, they'll tend, you know, even children are tend to show like great feats of strength or go crazy.
Yeah.
And then like.
He's nuts.
Yeah, the
stay away from him.
But the doctors leave, and then there's just this shadowy Tommy standing there, dressed like a dad, picking his daughter up from prom.
Yeah.
And he runs over and gives her a hug, and they're like, "Oh, that's the end of final Friday." And then the last shot is Tommy, like his eyes are closed tight when he's hugging his sister close, and then he just looks into the camera with this look of menace and
cold and
cold. Yep.
And it's,
that's the final Friday. But what were
for
some,
Jason
for,
cause that's the thing is they give it, this is the last Friday the 13th movie and they just set up for a sequel. So you can just rationalize it by saying it's supposed to be the last one for Jason. And then the fifth one, we do have Tommy Jarvis. It's not Corey Feldman.
Yeah.
He's a red herring.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole lot wrong with the fifth one. So much so that they brought Jason back for the sixth one.
Yeah.
The fifth one, I'm just going to say, it's not Jason. It's a copycat killer.
Yeah. Which, in and of itself,
he's wearing a Jason mask.
In so many ways, does not make any sense with how they try to pull it off. But however, we're not going to talk about it. Maybe next year, if you'd like us to riff it, we will.
Yeah.
But we're not going to talk about it. But this was the last of the ones where Jason and the stories were relatively grounded.
Yeah.
Like, again, we are really loose with the term relatively grounded because it's just so ridiculous as well.
Yep.
Speaking of ridiculous, like we had mentioned, some of the kills are the more famous, so you have a list of those.
Yes. So the character of Samantha, she dies first of the group. She's impaled with a knife while on a raft in the middle of Crystal Lake.
Mm-hmm.
The look on her face is, again, these are gruesome and they're grisly. And they can be unsettling for some people.
Yeah.
And the actress actually got hypothermia filming this scene
because
they were filming in, you know,
January.
In January. I thought.
December, January?
No, well, the woman who played Trish said they started filming on Halloween.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So
well,
it had to have been November.
Either
close
way,
December.
It was
either way,
25 degrees outside.
Yeah. There was a lot of, it rained a lot on set. It was cold. So that's what she does. Paul, her boyfriend, gets harpooned in the dick.
Yep.
By Jason.
R.I.P. Dick Butkus.
Yeah, exactly. By the Dick Butkus.
Yeah.
It's shortly after she's jealous because one of the twins wants to dance with Paul.
Right.
She's like, I'm going to go for a swim. And she goes for a swim, dies. Paul's like, I got to go talk to her. Discovers her on the raft, comes frantically swimming back and gets harpooned in the dick. Terry, one of the other twins who's not getting any. Put in reverse Terry. She is like, Tina, come on, let's go. And she's like, no, you go without me. And she's like, okay. And it's off screen.
It's one of the better shots.
We see a shadow and a shadow of her getting impaled by Jason. And then she's hurled across and gets stuck to the side of the house.
But what was cool about that shadow showing up? It was a flash.
What was it?
It was storming outside, so
it was a
dark.
Flash of
it was
lightning.
Dark, and it happened in the midst of a flash of lightning that illuminated the side of the house just enough to see her get stabbed by Jason.
So we didn't see it, but it's like off camera, and then she gets thrown into frame, and
stuck to the side of the house, which is a cool shot. The mom is killed off camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's just of her looking around like, where is everyone? She's like, and then it cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Trish finds Rob's tent. That was just a note.
what the hell are you doing here?
It was just a little note.
Yeah.
Jimmy, so Crispin Glover gets a corkscrew. Tag, Ted, where the hell's a corkscrew? Yeah,
that's one of the better timed ones.
Yeah, and he gets a corkscrew in the hand.
And a
meat cleaver in the face.
So one, two, the old 1-2.
Yeah, and the expression on his face is... Like a
yeah,
kind of thing.
But if it's one of those things where that's an example of it's short and sweet and you get the impact because the look on his face is alarming. But if you hold on it and you just like let it like you just let the blood like spurt out, you're just like it.
Okay,
loses
we get
the
it.
Effect,
he's dead.
You know,
Tina, the twin that boned Ted, she gets one of the
Bone Jim.
Crispin
Glover.
Yeah, she gets. She gets off, quote unquote, easy. She gets thrown out of a window on the top of a car, and the impact blows out all the windows, which is a really cool stunt.
Uh-huh.
Ted gets, so he's high. He's high as a kite
because
he's smoking doobies.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, hello? You know, because the film stops.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, so-and-so. And he's standing with his back to the projector screen and gets a knife in the back of his head through the projector screen. Doug. Who's Donny Osmond looking MF-er? Him and Sarah are the only two of the teens that I actually liked.
Mm-hmm.
Doug, Jason, he's in the shower. They just get done. Him and Sarah get done showering together, and he's still in the shower. And it's a sliding glass door on the shower. And Jason smashes his arm through the shower door to grab Doug's face, slams his head against the wall, and crushes his skull.
Oof. That's a
good effect.
That's another one, especially with the bulging eye like in there.
Yeah. Sarah, who comes through because she wants to hear him sing. You got a fun story.
Yeah, originally he's singing and she like leaves and she's like, oh, like all lovey-dovey. I think I'm in love.
It's gonna be
not
gonna
get enough. He's like, I think I'm in heaven. She's like, I think I'm in love. And I'm like, I think I'm gonna be sick. I think I'm gonna be sick.
But
she leaves and she's blow drying her hair, but she's gonna get back into the shower again because she goes back to the, when he thinks it's her, like when before Jason shoves his head into the face and shoves his face into the wall.
Yeah.
He's like, talk to the hand.
Talk to the hand.
But he's like, Sarah, you wanna come to the shower and sing a duet? And then like she goes back to the door.
I want
to
do it.
And she's like, I want to hear you sing. And she opens the door, and it's his head that's like on the broken glass. And I'm like, show's over.
But she is like, oh my God. And she's like running around, and she's like, Shelly's dead. Shelly's dead. If you go listen to last week's episode, we break into a whole song and dance at some point.
Yeah.
We're going to make you listen to the whole episode. Yeah. Anyway. She's yelling out for her friend, Sam, Samantha, who is killed. She's like, Sam. And there's an axe that flies through the door and gets her right in the chest.
Oof.
And it looks like it was shot out of a cannon.
Yeah.
That's what the effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and she's like, oh. And anywho, and then the last character that dies is Rob, who they're exploring the house that the teenagers were at, and there's like, oh my God, there's all this stuff that happened, and he has a machete and a small knife. He gives Trish, here, hold this, the machete, and proceeds down the basement stairs just with the little knife, and then Jason corners him, takes a little
gardening tool,
and just starts hacking away at him. And one of the most unsettling things when I first saw this movie is he's just screaming, he's killing me, which from what I understand a lot of people laugh at, but
it's polarizing.
I was very unsettled by that because it's like I've never heard of that as a reaction to someone being killed. Like, because I mean, you don't know, I've never been killed before, so I've never seen someone be killed, so I never knew like what the reactions were. So like the fact that would have been a reaction to someone being killed, like, oh my God, I'm being killed.
Seems very real.
It seems very real and very unsettling. And the more I thought about it, the more I'm like, okay, it is kind of silly. But I don't know. It felt very real.
Definitely I mentioned last week when Vera's death happens, it looks, the effect, there's very little done
to distort her face, yeah. So you see her reaction. It looks very yeah. It looks very real. Yeah. So the same thing looks yep. very real. And then we mentioned kind of the grotesque and disgusting way Jason goes.
Oh yeah.
But as we had mentioned before, Matt talked about the kills. Although the title is The Final Friday, and they did all this, put in all this effort to make yeah. this different than all the others, to really cap off a very popular series, a series that made Paramount money, although they were embarrassed by it.
They made five more.
They made five more. Yep. Because you can't deny the money, honey.
No way,
this
Jose.
This was not The Final Friday.
Nope.
It's not the final week for us, because not only are we coming back next week with another six mix, we will be coming back at the very end of 5 weeks of Fright with yet another Friday the 13th movie. Our favorite Friday the 13th
movie. A resounding refrain amongst Friday the 13th fans as the best.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot argue because it is good.
It does so much so very well.
Yeah.
Which we will get into when that time comes.
Yeah.
But until then,
be good to yourselves. Be good to each other. Because why would you want to be rude when you could be rad? We'll see you next time.